Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Fake TV Critic, a podcast where I discuss the week's biggest TV news headlines, recap and analyze some of my favorite shows, and let you know what you should be watching. It's been a couple of weeks, so let's talk about how, you know, what's been going on. So, number one, this came out of nowhere, but Yellowstone, which is one of the biggest shows, if not the biggest shows, on TV at the moment, as you probably know from me talking about it, linear television viewing has dropped quite a bit in the past few years with the boom of streaming. It's still the most popular way of watching TV, and that's mostly because of older folks and people who just turn the TV on and just leave channels on and that kind of shit. But the actual like ratings of people who sit down and specifically watch a particular television show has dropped quite a bit. Sports are obviously still big. News is still big. Especially like I said, the older you get, the more likely you are to just like leave Fox News on all the time, you know? So Yellowstone, for all intents and purposes, is probably at the moment the most viewed show on TV where people like specifically sit down to watch Yellowstone. And it's in, I think it's fifth year right now, and it might be going bye-bye, like, which is wild. But apparently Kevin Costner, who is the lead on Yellowstone, ostensibly the lead, like he doesn't have the most screen time, but he is the reason the show exists. He is the reason the show got ordered in the first place. He worked out in his contract, like how often he would need to be filming, like how many days he would be shooting the show, because he lives in California and the show, I believe, shoots in Montana as well as being set in Montana. And he like doesn't want to do it anymore. He's basically like, I'm tired of traveling back and forth. I don't want to be in the show anymore. But then his character is the linchpin of this particular iteration of Yellowstone. So perhaps this particular iteration of Yellowstone is going to go away. And, you know, this was maybe not the most shocking news in the world. One, because there probably is a shelf life on a show starring Kevin Costner. And I don't watch the show, but apparently there have been hints that his character maybe could be written off or will be written off, but how Yellowstone as it exists now may be in its final season, depending on how negotiations go with Kevin Costner. Now, there are a bunch of spinoffs that are happening. 1883 has already happened on Paramount Plus. There's a spinoff of that called Bass Reeves that is coming out. 1923 is currently airing on Paramount Plus and was renewed for season two. That's the Harrison Ford, Helen Mirren one. So there is for sure a way to continue telling these types of stories in this setting and in this family dynasty without it being Yellowstone proper. So that's that may be on the horizon. That was that was a big breaking news story like a couple of weeks ago. Also, CBS announced that they are going to replace James Corden and The Late Late Show with a reboot of At Midnight. So I hate The Late Late Show. I hate James Corden. The energy of The Late Late Show is always so strange to me. And part of it is him. Part of it is just that it's like, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. But they're going to be, and again, this is also very strange because The Late Late Show is on at 12:30 a.m. So to call something At Midnight and it's going to not be on at midnight is weird as hell. But anyway, The Late Late Show, once James Corden's contract is up at the end of the season, is going to be canceled and it's going to be replaced with At Midnight, which, if you are not familiar, is a show that was on Comedy Central. It was, I think it ended maybe two, three years ago, and it is a trivia show where like points are just randomly assigned by the host. It was hosted by Chris Hardwick on Comedy Central. It's very silly. And I watched a handful of episodes when people who I enjoyed were the panelists, and it was funny. It's like an improv show basically. And yeah, that's what, there we go. That to look forward to? Question mark. Also, Below Deck announced that it was going to be replacing Captain Lee in its flagship series with another captain. If you are watching this season of Below Deck, I hate this season because Captain Sandy from Below Deck Med took over. And if you have listened to my thoughts on Below Deck Med in the past, I hate Captain Sandy. I stopped watching Below Deck Med for, I think, a full season, probably like, I think I stopped watching during a season and then didn't watch a follow. Yes, I stopped watching during the season where Hannah got fired, and then I did not watch the next season because they brought Malia back. And all of it is because Captain Sandy is a toxic person who enjoys toxic people and creating a very toxic work environment, and it triggers me. So I do not enjoy her. I think she's awful. And she took over for Captain Lee this season midway through when he had a bit of a health issue. And I'm confused because Captain Lee said on Twitter that he wanted to come back, but maybe his doctor told him not to. I believe he is going to come back at some point this season based on like context clues of Captain Sandy speaking to Captain Lee in some of the previews. But regardless, apparently, according to Us Weekly, moving forward, Captain Lee is going to be replaced on the Below Deck flagship with Captain Carey, who was on Below Deck Adventure, which just finished its first season. And Captain Carey is fine. Like, I didn't think he was great, but I also didn't dislike him. But, like, this isn't truly exciting. I'm glad it's not Sandy. I can say that. I'm glad it's not Sandy. And I'm assuming it can't be Captain Jason from Below Deck Down Under because he's doing another season of Below Deck Down Under. But I think they could have also, like, you know, found someone new if they wanted to. But I wonder what this means for Below Deck Adventure, which I did not really like, and apparently neither did many Below Deck fans. It was a different production company. It felt kind of weird. But also, it's just, if you are a Bravo person or a Below Deck person, it's a very sad day because Captain Lee is our boat daddy. He's the stud of the sea. He's been a major presence on Bravo for a decade now. And I love Captain Lee because after the first season of Below Deck, which was awful, I hated it, but I watched all of it. He hated it. He did an interview with a yachting or sailing magazine, something like that, and basically like exposed all the filming secrets and being like, you know, they did not cast people who were actual yachties. They cast people who were just there to stir up drama. We had to teach them what they were doing. They didn't do this properly. They didn't have correct permits. Like, he hated his experience, and it was because the production company basically cast people who had no idea what they were doing. So they were learning on the job, but he's like, but they were doing actual charters. Like, you can't make up, like you can't cast people who have no idea what they're doing when they're expected to do the job of someone who does know what they're doing. You know what I mean? So he was pissed off. So I loved him from the jump then. And then when Below Deck got renewed for a second season, he came back. I was like, oh shit, what's going on? And then they like overhauled the cast and brought back the people who knew what they were doing and then cast people who were actual yachties. So I guess they kind of fixed their mistakes, and that was really interesting. And then I read his book. It was not great, but I read it. He has been at BravoCon, and he's just been like a very calming, mature presence on the network, and he's going to be missed. And I'm sure he'll still be around. Like, Kate Chastain left Below Deck, you know, three seasons or so ago, and she's still around. So hopefully we'll see more of him in a different capacity, maybe hosting a show or something. But I love Captain Lee. Anyway, so renewals and cancellations. Let's start with renewals. Outer Banks, which its third season is coming back, I think this week as of the release of the podcast, sometime in February 2023, got renewed for a fourth season. Uncoupled, which I was complaining about on the last episode as was canceled by Netflix, got picked up by Showtime. And let's dive into this for a second. So Uncoupled was canceled by Netflix after one season. It got picked up by Showtime for season two. Hooray, hooray. I loved Uncoupled. It's the Neil Patrick Harris, Darren Star sitcom about a gay man who was in a relationship, and in the pilot in the first episode gets broken up with by his partner of many, many years, and kind of has to re-navigate the gay world of Manhattan as like a man in his 40s, right? Showtime picked it up for a new season, but then it was also announced this last week that Showtime is not going to exist as we know it for much longer. So it's been Viacom, which owns Showtime and Paramount Plus and VH1 and MTV and, oh God, Nickelodeon and a whole bunch of other channels, CBS, has kind of been moving toward this where, like, if you are a Paramount Plus subscriber, you can add on a Showtime, you can add on Showtime to a bundle for a smaller price. So I guess that was successful because they're now going to be doing away entirely with Showtime as a standalone service. This is my understanding. I do not know if this is correct, so don't quote me on any of this until more clear information comes out. But my understanding of what this leaked internal memo, which, I mean, it wasn't leaked. It's, you know, they did interviews about it after the fact. But Showtime To Go, I think, is what it's called. It's kind of like when HBO became HBO Max. Like, HBO still exists as a channel, but if you're going to get HBO as a streaming service, you get HBO Max, right? So that's what's happening with this, where Showtime is going to still be Showtime as a channel. So if you get Showtime through your cable package as like a linear channel, it's going to continue that way. The name is going to change, I believe, still to Showtime with Paramount Plus or Paramount Plus with Showtime. I forget which. I think it's going to be Showtime with Paramount Plus on linear TV. And some, and they said some content, they have not said what, or if it's like past things or future things, is also going to air on that channel that is a that is Paramount Plus exclusive. So that's okay, cool, whatever. But then the streaming service, you can no longer subscribe to just Showtime as a streaming service. You will now have to subscribe to Paramount Plus with Showtime. You can subscribe to Paramount Plus without Showtime. That's going to be the essential tier, which is what I have, the one that's currently $5 a month. It's going up to $6 a month whenever this happens, sometime next month, I believe. But the premium plan, which I believe is currently $11.99 or something, or $9.99, is going to now include Showtime. And it's going to be called Paramount Plus with Showtime. So on TV, Showtime with Paramount Plus. Streaming, Paramount Plus with Showtime. And you will not be able to separate the two any longer. If you pay for the premium plan of Paramount Plus, you will get Showtime. And that's how you will stream Showtime things. That is my understanding. I don't know if that is actually what's going to happen. And we'll see once they announce, like, once the price goes up and they announce the actual deal. We'll see, but that's how I understand it. So Uncoupled is going to be on whatever the fuck that that streaming service ends up being. And I believe you will still be able to have Showtime Anytime, which is just the streaming version of your cable package. It's so confusing. So Showtime Anytime is like you put it on a Roku or a Prime, a Fire Stick, or like on your Android or Apple device, and you can then sign into your cable account and stream Showtime with your cable information. I believe you'll still be able to do that separately. Who the fuck knows? This is so confusing. Okay, so there we go. Cancellations. Disney Plus canceled The Big Shot, that John Stamos basketball show, and Mighty Ducks Game Changers, both after two seasons. This season of Mighty Ducks Game Changers was shit, so good riddance. Paramount Plus, speaking of, canceled Blood and Treasure. And then the upcoming seasons of both The People's Court and Judge Mathis are going to be their final seasons, which is wild. It's been decades these shows have been on the air. Like, I don't even know what daytime TV looks like without either of these shows, but we're going to find out soon. Okay, so that is our news. Holy fuckballs. Okay, so I let's talk about you on Netflix first. So I think I talked about, yes, I did. I talked about either on the last episode or the episode before about Netflix starting to crack down on like password sharing in different countries. It's coming to America at some point. We don't know when. Coming to America. We don't know when, but it's going to happen soon. My guess would be sometime in the next few weeks, because this is the first time You on Netflix has been split up into two halves of its season, and it's one of Netflix's most popular shows. So I would assume that they, sometime between season part one of season four and part two of season four releasing, which part one came out on February 9th, part two comes out on March 9th. I would imagine sometime before March 9th, they're probably going to crack down on password sharing, so you have to buy your own account to watch the second half of You. That is my cynical mind thinking. But also, why did they divide this season into two halves? That is my question. Because, I'm sorry to say, it's not very good. And that pains me. So I have been watching You, and I've been watching You since it was on Lifetime, okay? So I had been aware of the book, and I have author friends and authors that I follow on social media from my romance publishing days, which I'm sure I've talked about in the podcast before. And they were all promoting the shit out of this You show. And it was Penn Badgley, who I knew from Gossip Girl, and it was about serial killers. And I was like, this looks cool. So I watched the first episode on Lifetime live, and I was fucking hooked. I went out to the library the next day and got the book and read it all in like two sittings. Went back, got the sequel, read that over the weekend. So like before the second episode of You ever aired live, I had read both books that were available. I loved it. I loved the first season. And then it got canceled by Lifetime because Lifetime moved away from doing TV series and was now focusing on doing movies of the week, and it got picked up by Netflix. And Netflix made it even better because they, you know, could go gorier, they could go darker, they could really take the source material and do it even better justice. So I loved season two. I really liked season three, which was Joe and Love settling down and like trying to, and starting a family and trying to like be normal, quote unquote. And then Joe becoming obsessed with Marianne, I forget how he says her name. And meanwhile, like the books have also continued, but on a separate storyline. And I have found the storytelling in the books to be better than the storytelling of the TV show, which is strange because I thought the TV series, the first book is the first season of the show, and the second book is very close to the second season of the show, and then they diverge. And I found the first two seasons of the show to be superior to the first two books, which is odd, doesn't usually happen. But like the ending of the second book was very weird and surreal in a lot of ways. So like, but in a different way than the regard, you know what I'm talking about if you've seen the TV show. And now these like separate storylines, I now find like I thought the third book was more interesting than the third season. And the fourth book is coming out in April. I have an advanced copy that I haven't started yet, but based on the synopsis, the fourth book, Joe goes to Harvard. In the fourth season, which is the first half of which just released, of the TV show, Joe is in London. Because if you remember at the end of season three, skip ahead if you skip to the drag race section, you know, just keep hitting that 30-second button until you start hearing me talking about RuPaul, if you don't want to hear any spoilers for You. At the end of season three, Joe and Love tried to kill each other. Joe was successful and he killed Love, burned down their house, dropped his son off at a neighbor's house to be raised, and disappeared and made it and cut off one of his own toes to make it seem like he had died in the fire and his body was burned beyond recognition, except for this little bit of evidence, right? So he disappears and he moves to London, where he assumes a name, and we get a backstory on how this happens. And it's very You and very interesting and, you know, kind of like suspension of disbelief, right? And he assumes this moniker of Jonathan Moore, I think it is. Jonathan, I know it's his first name. I think the last name is Moore. And he becomes a private school teacher in London, which like wild, silly, stupid, but whatever. And moving Joe to like an entirely new hunting ground overseas is an interesting concept. Like Carolyn Kepnes, who wrote the books, did this after season two or after the second book. She did it for every book. Book one was in New York. Book two was L.A. Book three was the Pacific Northwest. Book four is going to be in Cambridge in New England. So, not Cambridge. Yeah, Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Harvard is. So Massachusetts. So she's kind of moving all over. You, the TV show, did that on a lesser scale. Went from New York to LA and now is in London. So they spent two seasons in LA. So giving him a whole new hunting ground is great to kind of reset the show. giving him a new identity is great to reset the show. And we get all this stuff of like Joe wanting to turn over a new leaf and be a different person and like shut off his urges to murder and all that good stuff. And it's an interesting approach to where Joe is still the center of the show, but he's no longer the villain. And part of what I thought always made you both the book series and the TV show so interesting is that Joe is so clearly a psychopath. Obviously, he talks about it in the books and in the voiceovers in the show. He is a psychopath. He is a murderer. He is the villain. He is the person we're not supposed to root for. But for some reason, he's so endearing and charming. And the brilliance of this is that that is what psychopaths do, right? They know how to manipulate people. And that is what Caroline Kepnes and the writers of the show did with Joe. We know that he's bad, but he's so good at being bad that he manipulates us into thinking that he's good and into rooting for him. And that is so fascinating that, like, using the psychopathy to also make the psychopath so relatable and likable is scary. And I love it. But regardless. But now making him kind of the hero, as season four does, flips the show in a way that I don't think is actually all that successful. So in the first episode, we hear all this, like Joe is now living in London. He's trying to be different. He's trying to start over. He's pushing out his urges, even though he's like introduced to all these people who are so terrible, right? Like they're rich, they're awful, they're snobby. And he's in like the epitome of snob culture of like a private school that's very Oxford-like. And it's very interesting to see him not be a killer and not give in to his urges in that setting. But then, of course, halfway through the episode, Joe wakes up after blacking out from a party and there is a dead body in his apartment. And he doesn't know if he did it or not. He realizes very quickly that he could not have and that someone's trying to frame him. So then we get Joe as the detective Poirot, Agatha Christie, the Kenneth, you know, the Murder on the Orient Express dude, Hercule. We get Joe as like detective in an Agatha Christie murder, trying to figure out who is framing him and why. And I'm gonna be honest, it's not a great way for the show to continue. Seasons one and two, especially, also season three, but especially seasons one and two, is super in it, it's very in it's easy to what's the word I'm looking for? Like you, it's so easy to binge and it's so easy to fall into and it's so easy to get wrapped up in. And it's so well paced and it's interesting, but that's not what I mean. And so intriguing, but like, it's just so easy to like, and to get invested in because it is not a traditional mystery. It's not a traditional whodunit. It is like, it's true crime, but from the perspective of a killer who we are trying to both understand, but also we hope gets caught, but we don't want him to get anything bad to happen to him because he's also our way into this world. It's very layered and it's fun to watch because of that, to like see how is he going to get away with this? What is going to happen? But then like to make it a traditional mystery, a whodunit, is not interesting. Like, Joe on his own without being a psycho is, I don't think, interesting enough to sustain that kind of storytelling. And, like, the middle episodes of... So it's been 5 episodes, right? It's a 10-episode season. Like I said, it's cut in half. So the first episode is, like, a reorientation. Where are we? What's happening? That's fine. And, like, setting the story up. But then, like, episodes 2 and 3 are just kind of very meh. There's like a new victim and it's Joe trying to figure out what's going on. And we're getting introduced to all these new characters, but then like he's trying to be different. And Penn Badgley did a whole series of interviews where he said that he asked the creators and writers to not put in sex scenes for him because he wanted, because of his own personal life as Penn Badgley with his wife and shit. So like, he has an object of his obsession, like he always does, who's a woman, but like, she's very different than Love or what was her name in the first season? Bex and Marianne. So it's like we're watching a whole new show with these characters from a very different show. And I didn't like it as much. I still sped through all the episodes. I watched them all in one day. It's just not nearly as interesting, I don't think, to do it this way. And with Carolyn Kepnes writing different stories and like giving them options of things they could do and places they could go and stories they could pull from, it's very strange that they went this like very traditional mystery route. And like, ugh, how exhausting that, like, you know, he's in the UK and doing like the epitome of a UK mystery, and it's just, and it's like lowest common denominator shit, you know what I mean? Like Agatha, like there's a whole conversation where one of Joe's students is like, well, Agatha Christie is the most popular author in the world for good reason, because it's clever and she makes people feel smart even though it's formulaic. And like, rather than subvert it, rather than like acknowledging that's what's happening and subverting it, which is what I think You seasons 1 through 3 did, it just follows the formula. And like, where's the interest in that? I don't know. It's weird. I didn't entirely like it, but if I still have a password to Netflix by the time the second part of the season comes out, I'm gonna speed through it. I'm gonna watch it. But it's just, I will say one good thing they did is that they reveal the identity of the killer in the 5th episode. Because if this had been 10 episodes of Joe trying to figure out who this Eat the Rich killer is, which is what they call the person, I would have been done and out. But they reveal who it is in the 5th episode, and I'm assuming the second half of the season is going to be Joe trying to take down this person, which will be more in line with what I enjoyed about seasons 1 through 3. Will be, you know, like if maybe now, rather than having it be like Joe caging and, you know, hunting susceptible women or whatever, he's going to be hunting someone who's like kind of on his level. Maybe that could be interesting. I just wish that it didn't take as long to get to that level or to get to that story. So first 5 episodes of season 4 of You are currently streaming on Netflix. The second 5 are coming out on March 9th. Let's switch gears and talk about the other show that I, like one of the only shows that I have been consistently and obsessively watching is the 15th season of RuPaul's Drag Race. And I haven't talked about this yet this season on the podcast, but I did mention it a little bit a couple episodes ago when I talked about the real friends of WeHo, because everyone on the internet is up in arms about Drag Race being 60-minute episodes again rather than 90 minutes. And I don't mind it. I think this season of Drag Race is the best season probably since season 9. I'm going to say season 9, but maybe even season 8, because as much as I loved season 9, I think season 8 was the last truly great Drag Race season, which was before it moved to VH1. I think this is the best season in many years, at least since season 9. So I'm not hurt by the hour-long episodes. I think, you know, like, do I wish we had more, because there are so many queens. There were 16 queens this season. Do I wish we had more time with some of these queens before they left? Yes, of course. I love to watch them get prepared. I love to watch their conversations. And I love to watch the actual drag performances. And I feel like that suffered a little bit with the shorter runtime, but only because there have been so many queens. Like, now that we're kind of around the halfway mark of the season, I don't feel it as much that the episodes feel rushed. It felt that way in, like, episodes 1, 2, 3, 4, especially they did Snatch Game very early this season. So it felt rushed when there were 14 queens. It's episode 3, and we have to watch 14 queens do Snatch Game. There were some queens that we didn't even get a joke from. Like, we saw them, and we knew they were there, but, like, we didn't get to see them do anything. So that kind of sucked. But overall, I think this season is very successful. The cast is great, and I'm really enjoying it. So, suck it. You know, I don't think that this show needs to be 90 minutes. You know, I fell in love with it way back when it was only an hour, you know? The hour and a half episodes, I think, started in season 10, maybe 11. it hasn't been that long that the show's been an hour and a half. Like, the best episodes, the best seasons of the show were when it was an hour. Sorry to say, the best seasons of the show, I think we all can agree, no matter who you are, whatever you put at the top, were 2, 4, 5, 6. All hour-long episodes. Sorry about it. 9 is up there too. So sorry. Don't care. And also, I've been enjoying Real Friends of WeHo, as I mentioned a couple episodes ago. Like, if this was on any night besides Friday, like, if people didn't blame Real Friends of WeHo for cutting back Drag Race by a half an hour, the gays would be falling over themselves to be watching the show and tweeting about it and ripping it apart the way we do The Real Housewives. Also, speaking of, I compared on my... when I talked about Real Friends of WeHo, I mentioned that it felt very much like the A-List New York, and I mentioned a whole lot of those similarities. Apparently, according to a bunch of cast members who are now, like, just talking, including Todrick, it was a reboot of the A-List. When they cast it, when the people on the show agreed to do it, they were told, this is the A-List Los Angeles, it's a reboot of the A-List, and it's going to be on Paramount+. They had no idea they were going to be on MTV. That they were going to be on after Drag Race. They had no idea their show was going to be called The Real Friends of WeHo because they knew they were not, which is one of the main criticisms people have had of, like, we can tell these people are not friends. I think I even talked about it on my recap and of the premiere. That's one of the main criticisms. And it's like, well, we didn't sign up to do a show that was set around West Hollywood or that was going to pretend we were friends. It was supposed to be about all of us being, like, gays at the top of our game. And then finding out all these other people that they had interviewed for the show that never got cast. Lance Bass, Willem from Drag Race Season 4, Monet Exchange from Season 10, and All Star 7 All Winners. There was someone else. Who was it? I forget. There was another bigger name that Todrick or someone had mentioned was supposed to be on it. Oh, Jonathan Bennett. James admitted that they interviewed his husband first. So... knowing what the show could have been and maybe was supposed to be and the way that it was supposed to be presented, I have a different respect for it as well. But that's neither here nor there. Back to Drag Race. So season 15, 16 queens were halfway through. This last week was a lip sync Lollapalooza, which, like, is around the time the wheels start to fall off. Like, again, you could see the producer intervention, just like last season when Jasmine Kennedy somehow went home in a lip sync challenge. And, like, she didn't lose any of her lip syncs, let alone all of them. Same thing this season. Jax went home this last week. She'd been in the bottom twice before, but, like, she never should have lost all of her lip syncs. I thought she won her first lip sync against Mistress Isabel Brooks, who, let's talk about the cast for a second. Like, I don't really know how I want to approach this recap because I'm just going to talk generally about the season. Mistress Isabel Brooks. The fandom loves her. The podcasts I listen to love her. The tweets and Reddit posts and things that and Instagrams that I have seen love her. I want to love her. I just don't. And I don't know why. She is old school and very pageant-like, like huge makeup, huge hair, over-the-top costumes. I love that shit. What I don't love is who she is on the show and how much of that is just editing not giving her the correct context. Like, there was an episode where she was part of a fight. They were trying to decide. There were three groups, and two of the groups they were all to sing songs. Two of the groups wanted the same song. And she was a part of a group that was like, well, we're going to do this one. You do this one. Well, no, we need to decide how we're going to do it. Well, no, we decided we were doing it. You figure out how you're doing the other one. And, like, it was her and Lux and a couple of other queens who were a part of it, who later were like, we weren't actually fighting over this. Like, we were just kikiing, having a good time, like, shading you, like, being ridiculous, like, dressing room brouhaha, you know? Which is very common in dressing rooms. Like, even not being a drag queen, but being an actor, like, you rib each other in dressing rooms. That's what you do. When you're behind the scenes and you're doing the same shit over and over, that's what you do. You make fun of each other. You poke at each other. You have that camaraderie, that bond where you can do that. And we've seen a little bit of that with Mistress and Malaysia, where, like, they talk shit about each other, but they do it in a very playful way where they aren't actually serious. But then Mistress, I think, takes it to a level where others can't tell when she's being serious or not. And whether that's an editing thing or whether that's just her personality, where she thinks she's being funny, but it's coming across as kind of mean girl, I don't know. it reads to me on the show more frequently as Mean Girl than it does as funny shade. Like with the fight with Malaysia, with this fight over country versus heavy metal in the, what was it, the Golden Gal Groups, Golden Girl Group Challenge, I think it was called. She comes off to me as very dry in her confessionals, and I typically like dry humor. And she had some great one-liners this last week, but, you know, when she was like, the CDC should really look into making a vaccine for drag delusion because at this point it's contagious. Like, that shit's funny. And the delivery of it was funny. But it, her delivery to me does not always work. So I don't like that. I also thought that she's been better in challenges that she lost. And then when they gave her the win for the Daytona Wind Challenge, I don't think she was the best. I think she had some really bad line readings. Like, she knew that the jokes in that script were references to RuPaul's Drag Race quotes. And she basically got Aura to give her the best role because she understood that. But then even in her own line reading, she had some, like, she didn't, there was one, okay. The example is when Big Daddy dies in the skit, she says, it was rigor mortis, girl, which is like, it's rigor mortis is rigor mortis. It's an Alyssa Edwards quote, but like, it means that he died. So like, they're applying it to an actual situation of someone being dead. And rather than saying like, oh yeah, it was rigor mortis, girl, and like acknowledging the connection to Alyssa Edwards, she went, it was rigor mortis, girl. And like, it's just, it's not a good line reading, and no matter what she was saying, but especially knowing the context of the line, it was bad on top of that. And that just stuck with me. And like, she was good, but I thought there were other people who were better. So I also don't like when production kind of fucks with the way that we see things and tries to push certain queens in certain weeks when they could have and should have pushed them in different weeks. Which brings me again to the lip sync with Jax. If they want, like, Jax clearly was not sticking around much longer. She was in the bottom 2 weeks in a row, and they get to a lip sync challenge where it's a lip sync round robin. This person lip syncs against this person, then two more go, then two more go, then two more go. And the people who win are safe. The people who don't have to lip sync again until we're left with two girls. Well, they did it at the wrong point in the season, and there were three girls left. So they introduced this challenge, or this like twist, that the person whose name gets picked can save one of the other two queens and basically choose who they lip sync against for the final lip sync, and the loser of that one goes home. It's just stupid. Just either do, which, and they already did a three-way lip sync. Do you know what? Like, they could have fixed this so many other ways and had, like, in the three-way lip sync, save two girls and put one in the bottom rather than save one and put two in the bottom. Like, it was just strange. And to send Jax home in a lip sync challenge made no sense, because not only should she have not lost her first lip sync against Mistress, bringing it back to Mistress, I thought she won that lip sync. Mistress was good. But, like, she was doing a thing that I think is appropriate for some songs, but like, this is a Taylor Dane song that is very catchy, but ultimately meaningless. Do you know what I mean? Like, it should be high energy, but there's not like an emotional, really, there's not really an emotional element to it, I don't think, that Mistress connected with that Jax didn't. I just thought Jax was more entertaining. And that's me. That was all the girls on the show. All the girls who were already safe and watching thought that Jax won too. So it's not just me being delusional and not liking Mistress or being contrarian or whatever. So I don't think Jax should have lost that one. And I also don't think that she was that bad in the end. And then I also don't think that with this twist at the end where like it's Anitra, Spice, and Jax. And Anitra also shouldn't have been there at the end. Saves Spice because she doesn't think it's quote unquote fair to lip sync against Spice because she'd wipe the floor with her. Which, like, okay, Spice sucks, but that's why Spice should be going home. If this is a lip sync challenge and Spice is a shit lip syncer, she should be going home. That's the point of this show and the way it's set up. So to save Spice and send Jax, who is a wonderful lip syncer, home in a lip sync episode was very stupid and felt very contrived. Because even though it's Jax's, it felt very much like Jax's time to go. They were not connecting with her. She'd shown all her big bag of tricks. Even still, send Spice home this episode and send Jax home next week. Because if Jax's strength is lip syncing, just let her go through. Do you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't make any sense to send Jax home in this challenge when they could just send her home next week. And, like, whatever you do next week, the manipulation does not have to be crazy for us to believe that Jax should go home if she'd already been in the bottom twice. Do you know what I'm saying? And then almost went home again in lip sync, but, like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, clearly Spice is also not long for this world either. So what's the difference if you swap when they go home? Because the preview for next week is a ball challenge. And Spice is not going to win or be safe in a ball challenge at this point in the competition. She's just not. Like, I can almost guarantee it's going to be Spice in the bottom next week, and then probably Selena, because she was in the bottom during the design challenge. So it's probably going to be Selena and Spice, or maybe Spice and Marsha, although she had a great look during the design show. I don't know. Regardless, like, you could easily have... Jax did not have a great look during the design challenge. You could easily put her in the bottom this week if you wanted to send her home with whoever else. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it feels weird and, again, very produced. But I don't mind it as much this season because the crop of queens is so strong. It really burned my butt last year because they pushed Diabetti through to the end. And I thought she should have gone home in the lip sync episode then when Jasmine went home. And they pushed her through to the finale and it was pointless because she didn't do anything. Like, she was never going to win. They just put her in the finale because they wanted a villain. You know what I'm saying? But this season, the crop of girls is so strong that, like, once we get... Jax obviously was not going to be around much longer. Spice is not going to be around much longer. And then once those two are gone, we're left with a really strong group of queens. Like, Malaysia and probably Marsha are maybe the weakest then of those. And Marsha is one of my favorite queens of the whole season. Like, that's how good this crop of girls is. Is that once you get down to... Oh, and Selena. But, like, once you get down to, like, 6 or 8 queens, it's still a really great cast. And every elimination, once Spice is gone... I'm sorry to say this. But once Spice is gone, every elimination is going to be heartbreaking because the girls that are left now are... great. Not only great drag queens, they're great at Drag Race. Like, they give great confessional talking head moments. They are funny. They're fashionable and stylish. And they all have, like, you know, strengths, but also places where they can grow and change. And I'm loving this season. I just am. And also, going back to the 90-minute episodes, we're going to get 90-minute episodes again beginning March 10th. So, the last few episodes of the season are going to be longer. So they're going to re-edit them. We're going to get to see more of these queens. And, like, hooray, bravo. You know, I love it. Right now I'm predicting a top 4 of Sasha Colby, who is everyone's front runner. And if she's not your front runner, you have a problem. Icon. If you pay any attention to drag outside of Drag Race, you've heard the name. She is Carrie Colby from last season, her drag mother. She is legendary. She is a Miss Continental. I don't mean this in any way to be condescending or ageist. She's an older queen, so she's been around for a while, and that is to say that she has experience and is fucking good at what she does. She is a fierce ass fucking lip syncer, as we all saw in this last episode. Also, Anitra, God, I love... The lip sync of Sasha and Anitra is... like, immediately went into the Drag Race Lip Sync Hall of Fame. It was so fucking good. Anyway, so I'm predicting a top 4 of Sasha Colby, Mistress, who, even though I don't love, I can recognize is great at the show, is great at drag, and represents not only the big girls, but also an old school style of drag, so that'll be great. I think Anitra... probably, who is, like, Brooklyn Heights described her on the pit stop this week as the silent front, or maybe it was Bianca, as the silent front runner, which I agree with. I thought she won all of her lip syncs, even though she lost 2 of them. I thought she won them all. Going back to the premiere episode with the Walk That Fucking Duck and the talent show where she split the boards and duck walked and lip synced. And, oh, I love her. She's such a performer. I think she's so funny. I loved her, even though her group lost the Golden Girls Challenge, thought she was great in it. I thought she was great in the acting challenge. I love her. I think she's been wonderful. I think she's very funny. I think she's very talented. So I'm predicting her as top 4. Or if there's a top 3, I think that's the 3. If there's a four, if we're doing a top four again this year, it's between either Lux Noir London, who I loved her music before this season. I'm a little torn how I love and how I feel about her being presented on the show. On the one hand, I think she's hysterical and I love how aware she is of how she's portraying herself. I think she's very smart, but I also can see how she comes across as very condescending and arrogant, and people don't like that all the time. I think she's wonderful. I think she's been doing great on the show, even though I do think she has a bit of an inflated sense of self, but that's also great. She's a drag queen. She should. So they're going to be Lux or Lucy LaDuca, who I also love is a classic camp musical theater vaudeville type of queen. So those are the top five, I think. And if there's a top four, it'll be one of those two. If there's a top three, I think it's Mistress Sasha and Anitra. And they'll be a great top three. I'm loving the season. You have to catch up. It's on MTV this year, Fridays at 8. Yeah, go do it. Go to it. It's the only thing that sucks about it being on MTV now is that you have to, like, it's not all, you can only watch it if you have MTV as a subscription. Like, they're not putting it anywhere else, which I think maybe they also do with VH1. I forget. Regardless, it's on MTV. Go find it if you have a cable package. If you don't find someone with a cable package, use their login. All right, recommendations. My recommendation for the week is a movie. So I mentioned, I think last time, that I had been watching a lot more movies than TV lately, and that I think is still probably mostly true. But this past week, a movie came out on streaming that I got to see last year during a film festival. And at the Lambertville Halloween Film Festival, I saw this movie called The Outwaters. And the director, who is from Jersey, the New Brunswick area, was there. His name's Robbie Banfitch. He did like a Q&A, and it was such a strange movie. And I had already seen, like I said, it was a festival. So I had seen two movies before that, gone to get dinner, come back to see for this screening of The Outwaters. And the way the director is very big on no spoilers. So the way it was described was basically, I think the only thing we knew about it was a group of friends goes into the Mojave Desert to film a music video and they disappear. That was the log line of the movie. So that's all I'm expecting, the Blair Witch Project, but in the desert instead of in the woods. And on some level, that's what I got. But okay, so this movie, I'm going to try to describe it again without spoiling, because experience of this movie is going to vary greatly. You may hate it, you may love it if you decide to watch it, but there's not really a way, I think, to know what's going on. It's going to be up to each individual person to kind of decide or figure out for themselves how they feel. So it is four friends. It's a found footage movie. They go into the desert to film a music video for their one friend. One is like a makeup person, one is crew, and then Robbie is the director and the other girl is the singer, right? So they go to film this music video and they start hearing like weird sounds at night and seeing weird things, and there's like storms, and they chalk it all up to like natural phenomena like thunderstorms and coyotes and earth vibrations and things like that. And the first two thirds or so of the movie is very slow, and it kind of lulls you into a false sense of security that way. And it's, I don't want to say boring, because it's not boring. I was never bored during this movie, despite the fact that it's like, for a horror movie and especially found footage, it's long. It's an hour and 50 minutes, 5-0. That's long for a found footage. Like, I think Blair Witch is like an hour and 20, right? So about 2/3 of the way through, shit hits the fan. And everything almost literally turns upside down and it becomes a horror film. And it's very cosmic horror, Lovecraftian, Event Horizon, Blair Witch in the desert. My original review on Twitter when I saw this described it as Blair Witch on bath salts, which I'm still very upset, never made a poster. I thought that was a great quote. But that tweet got a lot of traction. The director retweeted it, sort of the movie account, but like that. If you're a fan of horror and of found footage, like if someone says the epitome of found footage horror is Blair Witch and someone says it's that, but even more fucked up, you're going to be like, how do I see this movie? So it's very dark and disturbing and bloody and gory and loud. When I saw this in the theater, it is an assault. It was an assault on your senses. It is going from dark to blinding light, seeing things on the periphery of the camera and therefore of the screen that, like, is that there or is that not? Shadows and moving things and, like, blood gushing and water. But then is it blood or is it water? Are we underground or are we in the desert at night? Are we in a tent? Am I seeing through a flashlight or is that the moon? And it just, it's, and then it's so loud and they're screaming and rumbling and high-pitched frequency noises and animal sounds. And it's just, it's, I think, supposed to make you feel like you are going through hell because it's kind of like what the characters are experiencing. It is absolutely insane and wild, and it kind of makes no sense, but that's also kind of the point. So for me, it's not so much that it was scary, although it is definitely a horror film. It's that it's so unsettling and disorienting. And I'm going to be honest, my immediate reaction after I saw this screening around Halloween was that I hated it. My gut reaction was, what the fuck did I just watch? I hated that. And the director did a Q&A and we tried to get answers out of him. Like, one of the people I was with was like, what is actually happening? And he kind of did the director thing where he was like, I could tell you what I envisioned, but then I don't want to tell you what to think of my movie. I want everyone to kind of have their own interpretations. Well, this movie, The Outwaters, has been playing in theaters for a couple weeks now. And over the weekend, as of this past Friday, the 9th, I believe. No. What the hell was this past weekend? The 9th is when it started in theaters. So maybe you can go check it out in a theater, which I highly recommend. Like I said, it is an assault on the senses. It is an experience seeing this movie. It is experimental. It is weird as fuck. It's an experience seeing it in a theater. And even though my reaction to the movie itself initially was that I did not like it, I've thought about it so much since then, and the experience of it is worth having. So if you can go see it in a theater, I recommend it, actually. But as of this past weekend, the 16th, it is streaming on Screambox, which is a horror streaming service. They also have the Terrifier movies, Terrifier 1 and 2. It's $5 a month, so you can watch the movie for $5, which is cheaper than if you rent it on, like, iTunes or Amazon, and you get a full month and all the other shit. But if you don't want to pay, you can do a free trial of Screambox through Amazon Prime channels. You get 7 days for free. You can watch it that way for free and then just cancel your Screambox subscription. So a little workaround there. But regardless, at the screening I went to, we tried to get answers out of the director. He wasn't very forthcoming with them, and that's okay. Because as much as in the moment I wanted an explanation of, like, I just sat through a nearly two-hour movie. What the fuck did I just watch? The experience of it and going back and, like, the images on this movie have literally been in the back of my mind and every once in a while will haunt me, like, just pop up randomly for 4 months now. It's been since I saw this movie last. And because of that, because it was so weird and thought-provoking, I want to go back and watch it again, and I'm going to now that it is streaming. So that is my recommendation, is The Outwaters. Outwaters. Outwaters, which is a made-up name or made-up word for the movie. Again, kind of giving you an idea of, like, what is going on in the director's mind, is that he literally started with an idea of a made-up word. Like, went from The Outlands to The Outwaters, which is not real. So it's very interesting. It's very interesting. And I'm curious to know how I'll feel again watching it for a second time and if I'll pick up on more things or if there just is no explanation. I don't know. Okay, streaming right now on Screambox, or you can get it for free with a 7-day trial on Amazon Prime channels. All right, that does it for me this episode. I'll be back next time with more recaps, more reviews, more news, more analyses, and more recommendations. Have a good one, everyone.